Hello everyone, welcome back to It's a Wonderful Podcast, the main show, episode 194. Nolan, we are talking another quite noir movie today. I would say certainly a more intense criminal, almost gangster movie compared to what we talked about a couple of weeks ago with Nightmare Alley, which is certainly a, you know, has its noir elements in its own right. This is a very twisted movie at times that we've got this week. It's a, like I say, it's a very, very intense movie. It was actually a first time watch for me, which people may be surprised about. I haven't actually watched everything. That is a major reason why this show exists, discovering new, older movies. Like I certainly did with this one. Nolan, did you also watch this one this week for the first time?
I did, and I was glad to find out that it wasn't a biopic about the KKK.
No, but, well, that would be quite funny, actually, given the title of the movie. That's also turns really dark. Let's not think too much about that. The movie, you know, we're talking about. Yes.
It put me in the mood, actually. There's this thing I do in my theater society with one of my friends. Just randomly, we start talking to each other in mobster voices, and it can go on for, like, ages.
Well, fortunately, we have at our center here probably the actor who the mobster voice basically comes from, or certainly the typical, you know, 20s, 30s, Prohibition era criminal idea comes from the image of James Cagney. Now, mainly it comes from the image of James Cagney in the early 30s. But, and you know, this movie we're talking about today is White Heat, by the way. Some would say it's Jimmy Cagney's best movie. White Heat, 1949. It's actually his return to Warner Brothers as a studio, because I think in the early 40s, he left Warner Brothers. I think there was a contract dispute and he left on fairly bad terms with Jack Warner, I think.
Doesn't surprise me, Warner Brothers, after all.
Well, I believe Jack Warner referred to James Cagney as that little bastard, which I find quite hilarious.
Do you want me to say that in a Scottish accent?
Did Jack Warner speak with a Scottish accent? No, I don't think he did, but you can do if you would like.
Jimmy Cagney, that little bastard.
Yeah, it feels appropriate. It feels appropriate because Jimmy Cagney is, of course, quite small, but that means he's a bulldog persona, and we like the bulldog persona in our intense gangster characters.
But yes, this was Jimmy Cagney.
That would be if he was Scottish. He isn't Scottish, unfortunately. But it is his return to Warner Brothers, this movie. He left, I think, to start his own production company, which didn't do financially great, but did make a few critically acclaimed movies, I believe. But he returned to Warner Brothers somewhat reluctantly, I suppose, or maybe not reluctantly, but certainly reluctantly on the part of Jack Warner, but at the request of the director of White Heat, Raoul Walsh, who is a really prolific director. Nolan, if you've never seen a picture of Raoul Walsh, I implore you to Google a picture of him now. His first name is spelled R-A-O-U-L.
Just look them up, and yeah. He looks like a kid's drawing of a dangerous man.
That's exactly what he looks like. I love the aesthetic of Raoul Walsh. He is a really prolific director. He's made some great movies in, you know, spanning years and decades and a long, long, long time. But this might also be the best movie of his that I've seen. because there's something very special, I think, about White Heat in terms of intense movies, in terms of crime movies, gangster movies, and in the careers of everybody involved. I think it's a really, really special movie. But I like that little behind-the-scenes story that I wanted to start this episode with, was the fact that Raoul Walsh basically said, no other man can play this gangster that we want to portray in this movie. I think it was based on a book anyway. Or it's based on other things, but I think White Heat's actually based on a book. Than Jimmy Cagney, because Jimmy Cagney is the embodiment of old Hollywood gangster. And he still very much is that. I think he is anyway. Do you?
I mean, I didn't know that he was like the origin of like where most gangster stereotypes come from. You know, for me, that's like Brando and Pacino. But
well, that's obviously much later, isn't it? It's a different type of the Italian mobster. Sure, that's, you know, that's a Godfather thing. Mainly, I would say.
There's always been a sort of Italian nature to gangsters anyway. Like, I would say even before The Godfather, like the whole, that feeling of family, the pristine suits, the accents, they all draw from, like, Italy's culture in a big way, and it's why I am yet to play a mobster on stage yet.
Well, does Scotland not have... I'm sure Scotland has organized crime or had organized crime, Nolan. I'm sure.
Yes, but they wear stained vests and tracksuits and eat macaroni and cheese out of a tin.
Does that not suit your style?
No, and also, actually, I do believe that the McGill's buses in Scotland is run by Scotland's crime unit.
Well, that's fun. I mean, we might get taken off with this episode now that we've outed that as being a potential fact. Who knows?
It's an open secret.
Okay. But ultimately, let's actually talk a little bit about White Heat in its all its glorious intensity. I'm going to keep saying the word intensity because there's no better descriptor, I don't think. What do you think about this movie?
I love stories like this where the main character is straight up unlikable, but you completely understand why they're that way and they're compelling. And it's down to a couple things: the writing of the character, Jimmy Cagney's performance, and being confident in it. Because you've seen many stories where they try to do an unlikable character and it just comes off as like edgelordy and like not at all convincing. But with this, and like I mentioned something like Nightcrawler or even something like Taxi Driver, these deep character studies that go beyond what their genres are, very interesting to me. And White Heat will probably be, I would put it above like Scarface and stuff now in terms of like great gangster character studies.
Is that a Scarface 83 with Pacino or Scarface 32 with Paul Mooney?
I would say both of them. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, look, you are right when you say that these movies that are deep character studies that elevate themselves to become more than simply the genre they're in, more than simply the movie they're in, are always very exciting. They're always very, like you said, compelling. You do find that gangster movies, or a few gangster movies, are of this kind, though. I suppose it's because you almost get two different types of gangster movies, don't you? You kind of get the stuff that's focused on the action, the stuff that's focused on the maybe the rise of it, or the rise of a collective, or something with a big cast of characters. But your solitary gangster movie, which essentially, you know, White Heat is and Scarface is, for example, are always better when their central characters are completely unhinged in whatever way that might be. You think of Scarface, okay, let's think of Al Pacino in Scarface in particular. He's incredibly aggressive all the time. He's ridiculously insecure. And he's just very, he's on edge constantly. He's constantly shouting. He's constantly, he thinks the world's against him, even when he's at his most confident. But he has this really backwards way of thinking about things. And in that movie, and in Scarface 32, he has a very overprotective relationship with his sister that can be read as potentially, you know, romantic feelings towards one sister.
Here it's with the mother.
It is. It's a Norman Bates situation we have in White Heat with Jimmy Cagney and his mother. Cody Jarrett is Jimmy Cagney's name in this movie. And
that too. Cody, something about the name Cody just kind of reeks of innocence to me.
You say that like it's a foul thing. Oh, the innocence. I can't stand the smell of the innocence.
I don't know a character named Cody who's not ever been like a sort of innocent, naive person.
Why do I get the feeling you're thinking purely of Cody from The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody?
I mean, he's the only other prolific Cody in media that I know.
I love it.
But yeah, there's a sort of that innocent naivety he has with the relationship with his mother, which is then counteracted with his completely aggressive side. You sort of get a sense that he's in that kind of mindset where he's never really been allowed to grow up and is kind of acting out a bit.
A little bit. It's a very, very interesting relationship because, you know, it's not like the situation with the sister in Scarface, where it isn't reciprocated. Like Mother Jarrett, but we'll call her Mar Jarrett because that's her name, is very much going along with Cody's crimes. She's very much going along in Cody's criminal gang. And she completely kind of backs up what, you know, how he feels towards her. It's a very mutual relationship there. It's very, very interesting because, like you say, there's love there. There's serious love there. It isn't even like Norman Bates in the sense where our lead character has a mother complex because his mother hated him. You know, Cody Jarrett's got a mother complex because he just loves his mother so much. And his mother loves him so much. They do anything for each other. Like, Mar Jarrett, at one point in the movie, goes to kill the kind of the traitor, as it were, of the gang, of the original gang. Of Cody Jarrett's original gang. They pull off a train heist at the beginning of the movie and try and get away, and there's a little bit of traitory going on. And while Cody is in prison, Mar Jarrett goes off, you know, she comes visiting Cody in prison, and then she goes off to kill. Big Ed is his name. Which unfortunately,
he's got a big head.
He has got a big head, yes. Unfortunately, it doesn't end particularly nicely for Mar Jarrett, but her dedication towards Cody is equal to Cody's dedication towards her, which is really interesting for me in that relationship, that it kind of goes both ways, neither helping each other out. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing that really caught my eye was at the beginning with the train robbery.
Yeah.
I remember there was this, I don't know if it happened afterwards or later, but it was when that person says his name. And then he just looks back and says, oh, you're good with names, aren't you?
Okay.
Which was pure fear inducing for me, just like the. You know, it reminded me of that scene from No Country for Old Men. It was like, how much you ever lost on a coin toss?
Yeah.
And then, of course, it being a gangster movie, you know, he whacks the guy.
Yeah, I get that. I like, you said it before, Cody Jarrett's very confident. He might be unhinged. He might be incredibly dangerous, but he's very, very confident. He's, I suppose he always feels like he's always in control. And a lot of the times he is in control. Except from when he absolutely, really, really isn't. If we continue our comparisons with Scarface in that way, you know, Tony Montana / Tony Camonte is always really in control, except from when he really, really isn't. And that's when it goes bad. You know, there's no middle ground, almost. I do like that line, actually, that you brought up. You're good with names, so we're going to have to kill you. Basically, because can't have you remembering, we can't have you talking.
Yeah, felt like a scene from like Grand Theft Auto or something like that, like a classic Grand Theft Auto game.
Yeah.
As they were always sort of based off mobster and gangster films anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I enjoy how this movie takes a lot of, well, it's got two main plot lines, I suppose. You're following Cody and his original gang, who then obviously double crosses him, like we've mentioned. Big Ed actually ends up running off with Cody's wife, who's played by Virginia Mayo, who is also very nice in this movie, I must say. Unfortunately, I don't think Virginia Mayo is actually given as much to do as I would like. Although Jimmy Cagney does continue his,
she could have been like a femme fatale kind of character, but no, she's not really.
She's not. I don't necessarily think the movie calls for it, which is a shame, I suppose. But it certainly doesn't, you know, it's certainly not a detriment to the movie, I don't think. But Jimmy Cagney does continue his trend of having scenes where he is slightly unnecessarily aggressive towards his partners, from The Public Enemy, where he shoves a melon or a grapefruit in Mae Clark's face during a breakfast scene. In this, he kicks Virginia Mayo off a chair onto a bed just because she says something he doesn't like, because we're not supposed to like Cody Jarrett, Nolan.
No, you're not supposed to idolize him. He is just a compelling character.
We are just supposed to be intrigued by him.
He is the villain of the story. Let's not kid ourselves.
Absolutely is. Absolutely is. Look, the protagonist-antagonist dichotomy, as it were, doesn't always necessarily have to be protagonist equals good guy, antagonist equals bad guy. Because in this movie, it's very much switched. Because you'd say the antagonist is probably the undercover police officer, or the undercover detective, played by, I think it's Edmund O'Brien is his name, who does really well in playing against Jimmy Cagney in this movie, I think. You know, it would have been easy for fellow actors to get lost when surrounded by this anchor performance of Jimmy Cagney, that he's just absolutely balls to the wall crazy a lot of the time. But Edmund O'Brien does such a good job. I really, really liked him in this movie.
I could see how that relationship would also inspire other similar ones, you know, something like The Fugitive or First Blood, which have relationships like that.
Yeah, I like that.
The Fugitive probably less so, but First Blood for sure.
I like that. See, this is why we love talking about these movies as well. The influence they have on movies that came later is so evident.
I think even Denzel sort of was in, because I looked up the final line of the movie that everybody knows, and there's a movie where Denzel says it, and it's almost an exact recreation of the scene from the end of this movie. But
okay.
It's not a remake. It's called Ricochet. It stars Denzel and John Lithgow. It might be like an unofficial remake of White Heat, but I've been told Denzel was very influenced by Jimmy Cagney.
I like that. I like that. Look, yes, you allude to it there. The ending of this movie is ridiculously famous. Made It Mar, Top of the World, is one of the iconic lines in movie history. It's, you know, up there with any such, up there with There's No Place Like Home, up there with I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse, You're going to need a bigger boat. Anything you could possibly think of, it is up there.
I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough and irritating, and it gets everywhere.
Not necessarily that one, but perhaps, you know, Use the Force. It's up there with those kind of, for knowledge, for just, I suppose, importance to movie culture. It absolutely is up there. And watching that ending scene for the first time, like I said, is so, watching this whole movie was so rewarding. I love watching these bigger movies that we cover on the show for the first time, because you finally realize why they are so well revered. And that's not to say that there hasn't been times on this show where I've watched well-revered movies for the first time and maybe haven't loved them as much as I felt I should. This is not one of those cases. This was, I was entirely gripped by this movie. I loved this movie from start to finish. It just, it got me. It played into my original kind of finding movies for myself when I first was really getting into movies and would watch a lot of gangster movies, would watch a lot of 70s gangster movies and 90s gangster movies and that sort of stuff. Because for some reason, that's what I was into. And perhaps when I was 14 and 15, I was viewing them in the wrong way. In glory.
Which is why you dress in a robe and you speak very calmly and slowly sip a drink.
Because I'm secretly deeply unhinged, obviously, as we all know. But I think watching such movies when you kind of mature a little bit, when you grow up a little bit and you realize what's actually going on, makes you appreciate them more, because you see how actually clever they are in what they're saying, because the subtleties are there that you didn't get the first time because they were almost too subtle for your younger mind to get. Or well, that's at least how I think about it. But my entirely favorite part about White Heat is actually the relationship that's built between Cody and, is his name Hank, or he goes by Vic when he's undercover, the detective.
Let's just double check that for you.
It really is. The relationship between Cody and his mother is interesting itself, of course it is. But this fake friendship, I suppose, that at times feels very, very real. You actually wonder whether, you know, the detective, Edmund O'Brien, you wonder whether Edmund O'Brien is even going to, you know, fulfill his undercover role.
Influencing another later 90s action film, Point Break.
Exactly. I suppose Point Break kind of, well, you can get away with it in something like Point Break where you actually are now part of the group that you are supposedly trying to take down. Not in the 40s, Nolan. We are dealing with strict Hays Code rules here, which is why sometimes I think the endings of movies can seem a little bit on the nose of the bad guy has lost, and this is why you shouldn't be bad. Because there is a line at the end of this movie, and Edmund O'Brien actually says it, and I'll paraphrase, but it is something like, Cody Jarrett finally got to the top, and it blew up in his face. The end. He's like, yes, you had to be that obvious about it, didn't you? Well done, Warner Brothers.
I really hope that we don't go back to those kind of eras. I like complicated movies and characters. And, like, especially there's a lot of... It pops up every now and then on, like, film Twitter discourse, the idea of you shouldn't be making characters like this as your main people, or you should have them as villains. And I'm like, come on, I think modern audiences are intelligent enough to know not to idolize a clearly villainous character.
But it's just silly. I know we talk an awful lot about movies released in the Hays Code period, obviously, on It's a Wonderful Podcast. But, you know, it was a very, very censored time, a very, very kind of difficult time for... You know, for I suppose freedom of speech, freedom of expression.
Because it was after the war, so people just wanted like sort of straight good guy, bad guy narratives for a while.
Well, no, but you think that the Hays Code came into effect in 1934. It was all about censorship and protecting the public from the ills of the world. Which, I mean, the public should be, like you said, the public should be intelligent enough themselves. And thankfully, obviously, in the late 60s, when the studio system fell apart, the Hays Code fell apart as well. Well, the Hays Code fell apart. The Hays Code was kind of changed and lessened, I suppose, throughout the decades until it completely fell apart. And that's when New Wave American cinema came in and you got really heavy movies like the early Scorsese stuff and things like that, where you could just do whatever you wanted. But I've forgotten what I was talking about now. But the Hays Code doesn't mean... I think what I appreciate a lot about movies like this that were made during the Hays Code is, yes, you get that on-the-nose ending of, obviously, the bad guy of the movie. Yes, he was our protagonist. Obviously, he had to lose, otherwise we couldn't have actually got the movie made. But look at how interesting the movie is in spite of the Hays Code. Look at how creative directors could be, and some directors could be, in spite of the censors. And look at what they could say in between the lines, in subtleties. It's so much more creatively impressive, I think, when you can see that these filmmakers, that these actors sometimes were playing so in between the lines, because they had to. And I think White Heat does that really well, because there's very, very twisted, dark things going on in White Heat between the lines. We've spoken about Cody's relationship with his mother, his, you know, Virginia Mayo playing Verna, his wife. She's kind of very, she's an unfortunate character, really, because she kind of gets done over by both Cody and Ed, or Big Ed, because Big Ed's generally unpleasant as well. And she's really strange. The prison scenes, which I really did like, actually, because, you know, for the middle of this movie, turns into a bit of a prison movie as well.
When and the Cody, way that Cody got himself a lesser sentence shows his intelligence as a character. He's not just... He might be unhinged in some places, but he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, of course he does. Of course he does. I really do like as well how they never actually tell us what is wrong with Cody, I suppose, because he has kind of fits of migraines a lot, or like they almost look like seizures.
It's, I think, really maybe quite... just in the time they might have not known like the actual terms for it.
Well, perhaps not, but in the movie, I mean, they don't actually ever say what he gets. They're very, very vague about it, and I quite like that, because it kind of leaves it up to us to figure out just how messed up in the head is Cody.
Yeah, and it could also be not to villainize people who might have the condition that
absolutely
they name.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good point as well. It could very much be that. I didn't admittedly think about that. That's probably my bad on that part.
But no, you get a lot of that even in modern criticism now. Like M. Night Shyamalan gets criticized for Split's portrayal of dissociative identity disorder.
But and it's rightly a good movie.
It's a good movie, but I'm not going to disagree with people who feel he presents it in a villainous way. But once again, you got to look at it in the context of the movie, which is what you've got to do here as well.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, opinion is opinion, but context of the movie is always very important. Always. Otherwise, we would be in a situation of we're never allowed to show anything because that's evil. Yes, but in the context of the movie, look at what's going on. The good guy of the movie, you know, defeats the evil person of the movie. But we're not allowed to show that anyway because it's evil in the real world. But you're not listening. Look at the context of the movie. You could have arguments like that with stupid people all day.
I'm glad you're not on film Twitter.
Who says I'm not? I just don't interact.
You're just scrolling through the feed like, oh, for fuck's sake.
I'm on old Hollywood Twitter. That's what I'm on. It's just constant pictures of Gene Arthur and Marlena Dietrich, and I love it. This is what I want from life. That's all I need. Celebratory of old Hollywood, because it deserves to be. It deserves to be. And movies like this deserve to be. Sometimes we talk about fairly nice movies on It's a Wonderful Podcast. This is anything but a nice movie.
Yeah, like Witchfinder General.
Witchfinder General was about approximately, let's try and work this out, 114 episodes ago, Nolan. That's several years. So stop holding that against me. It's a good movie. Okay.
I don't know, it's just a running gag.
It is a running gag. You are quite right. What did you make of the prison scenes, though, in this movie?
I mean, they were the parts that I found least interesting, if I'm honest. I was more interested in, like, the mindset of Jimmy Cagney outside of the prison system, because I suppose, like, when you confine somebody like that in a space, right, you're... The good part of it is that it's always going to be a tense situation because you never know if he's going to just, like, pop off on somebody or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's, like, it's the part where I kind of started checking my watch. Like, ooh. I was way more interested in the other stuff.
See, that I really loved it because, like I said, the build of his relationship with the detective, with Edmund O'Brien, I really liked that. It genuinely made me question whether Edmund O'Brien would actually properly fall in with Cody's gang, or was he just a really good actor?
Might be because I've seen that trope done before. Maybe that's why I checked out and I was more interested in the other stuff.
I get that. I do. I get that.
Like, I am watching Hannibal right now, and that's like a major element of that show.
Okay. But, however then, what about a pretty, I suppose, small, very, very significant scene that takes place in the prison, in the dining hall, shall we say. If you can call where people eat in a prison a dining hall, it's a dining hall. And they all walk in the dining hall and Jimmy Cagney, all 4'7" of Jimmy Cagney's there, looking like a... He looks... Do you know what Jimmy Cagney does look like? He looks like a pug.
A pug.
He does. He looks like a pug dog. And that's not an insult. That's just a... I love Jimmy Cagney. I think he's great. But he does have a very small dog kind of feel to him, where he's just kind of little legs running around a lot all the time, but really aggressively. You know? I feel like that's what pugs do. They've got tiny little legs, but they just charge around all the time, bashing into walls. which is why the pugs' faces look like that, because they just hammer themselves into walls all the time. I figured it out.
It's an evolutionary thing then, I guess.
I figured it out. No, I don't mean to insult Jimmy Cagney. I realise that was probably deeply insulting to Jimmy Cagney. But he has that persona, and that's why he played such good, you know, off-the-rails gangsters. Because he's able to bring so much presence, so much fear, so much intensity, while not being 6'5" tall, dark, brooding, handsome, stereotypically. He's the complete opposite. But then again, you've also got to think, what is Jimmy Cagney also famous for? And it's actually musicals and dancing. He won an Oscar for Yankee Doodle Dandy, the musical. He was first and foremost, I think, a vaudevillian. So he's very much musical, you know, singing and dancing kind of guy. So he's obviously very athletic and able to use his body a great deal as well. And he certainly does that in his more darker performances. And he certainly does it in this movie.
It's like very theatrical is what you mean.
Yeah, particularly in this scene in the dining hall, Nolan, when he finds out that Mar Jarrett is dead.
Has been killed. It was kind of the scene I was expecting to happen, and that's when the prison stuff got interesting for me, when it turns into like a full-on riot-slash-hostage situation.
Yeah, the escape's really fun. I love it. I was kind of... An exaggerated term would be, I was floored by this scene. But I was just surprised. I was stunned a little bit, positively stunned by this scene. And just how loud the reaction was from Jimmy Cagney. Just how intense, I'll use the word again, intense the reaction of hearing about his mother's death was when everybody else is silent in that dining hall and you just hear the scream and the thrashing around and the jumping on tables and the punching everybody in sight, the kicking and screaming. This is what I mean when you say, how can the other actors have to play such understated roles for the most part when you're going up against that kind of performance as your anchoring performance in your movie? It's incredible that they were able to put in performances at all when faced with such maniacal mania as that. But it's great on all fronts. I loved that scene. And like you said, it does turn into a hostage situation after that in the prison, an escape situation, which is very gripping as well. It's one of the more action-packed moments of the movie. And from then on, really, Jimmy Cagney's, or Cody Jarrett, he's going off the rails. That's his downward spiral, I suppose, isn't it? When he finds out that his mother died.
Yep, and then like they are all thinking like, oh, we're going to take him to an asylum. What they diagnose him with was, I don't know if I've ever heard of the term before, homicidal psychosis.
The need to murder people psychotically.
That feels like something they made up for the movie, if I'm honest.
It's probably a little bit made up. Well, it's probably not, because there's probably people that exist with that kind of situation, whether those terms are used in modern psychiatry probably isn't the case, I would imagine. But still, it's a really good... I very much liked the prison scene. I'm sad to hear that we disagree somewhat on the prison elements of the movie.
I mean, it's a good scene. It was just the part where I was like, okay, I feel I've seen this before, so I kind of checked out a little bit. It doesn't help that I'm also juggling uni stuff.
No, okay, yes. What about the What about when we get out of prison then? We break out of prison. Like I said, the downward spiral seems to turn. And you kind of get... Well, you get it a couple of times in the movie, really. You get a number of detective cars, undercover detective cars, going through this really rigorous locating and chase of Cody Jarrett and his gang. I found that stuff fascinating. This is what I meant about this movie. It's kind of two different plot lines. It's the police detective stuff and it's the Cody Jarrett stuff. And the detective stuff I genuinely found really interesting. They're quite extended scenes of, you know, Hanks, Edmund O'Brien's colleagues, kind of trying to triangulate the location of Cody Jarrett and his gang. And they do it like twice, I think, in the movie. I think the one time they're after Mar Jarrett, actually, the first time. And the second time they're trying to work out where Cody and his new gang of prison escapees have made it to. I really liked that sort of stuff. I felt that was really gripping action. I don't know what you thought about all that. Were you into it?
Yeah, that was the part where it was like, okay, we're picking up again. Because my favorite part of these kind of character studies is the downward spiral of the main character.
Yeah.
And then seeing like everyone just trying to panic and piece together. You know, the panic from the main character almost like goes on to the other characters as well as they try to like piece everything back together.
Yeah. I did. I really did like that. What about the final big finale? I suppose we will call this.
I mean, it's all been building to that. It's. I don't know whether to call it a tragedy or not.
Well, it is really. I suppose he's a very tragic character in a lot of ways. You might not like him, but he's a very tragic character. He's a sad character.
He literally could not live without the one thing in the world he loved.
No, which was his mother. I mean, here's a question. Does the movie condemn the fact that people should have relationships with their mothers? Not relationships with their mothers, but like loving... People should love their... This movie doesn't think people should love their mothers, is what I'm trying to say.
They should set boundaries, for sure.
I love you, Mum, but don't kill anyone on my behalf, and I won't kill anyone on your behalf, and we'll be fine. Is that the boundary?
You don't kill my mother, I don't kill your mother. Capisce? It's the kind of stuff
we're doing the accent now.
Yeah. You stay away from my mother and the cooking. It's only my cooking.
No, and you're getting Italian again. This isn't an Italian gangster movie.
This is just the only mobster voice I know.
Okay. Well, I don't know what to say to that. You carry on. You carry on.
Yeah, so my boy Jimmy Kenny, you know, he goes up on this oil tanker. He yells out some crazy thing about his ma seeing him on top of the world, and he shoots it. Goes up like a Christmas tree, man. It's incredible.
A Christmas tree? Does a Christmas tree set on fire? I don't think.
Well, if you put it in the wrong place, maybe.
Well, yeah, that is true.
Jimmy Cagney roasting on an open fire.
For God's sake. Oh, you stop ruining Christmas. Christmas has been and gone now, I know, for a year, but don't ruin Christmas by having poor Jimmy Cagney roasting on an open fire instead of some nice chestnuts. Jimmy Cagney's chestnuts roasting on the open fire. Yes, we've made it there.
Well, his chestnuts probably were the ones that got there first.
Oh, dear. Why,
Mom, my chestnuts are on fire.
I don't care. I'm not doing that. That's the boundary. There's the boundary, Cody. I'm not doing that. Horrible. Why are we talking about that? That's unnecessary. No, I really like that. I really like the finale as well. I obviously like I said before, I'm always further entertained by the fact that I'm knowing I'm watching such a historically well-revered movie for the first time, and a famous scene, a famous line in the context of the movie it comes in, which is something obviously I'd never done before with this one. So I always get excited about that anyway, but I really did like the big kind of little bit of a gun battle we have, a little bit of a standoff. Cody's going absolutely mental at this point. It's not quite on the big finale gun battle level of Scarface, Pacino's Scarface, or even Paul Mooney's Scarface, which is a little bit more of a gunfight, I suppose. But it's got its intensity there. It really has its... There were some times where Jimmy Cagney almost felt like he was doing some sort of impression of the Joker in his laughing maniacally. And I appreciated that because it actually takes place...
He would have been a good
Joker. It actually takes place in a chemical building as well, though, because that's where his... That's where this heist is taking place, this heist that he's going on, because he can't stop just doing heists. So as soon as he gets out of prison, they plan this other heist on this chemicals building, which, as people will likely know, a famous origin of the Joker, whether you choose to believe it or not, is the fact that he was in a heist in a chemical building and became the Joker because he fell into a vat of chemicals. So when Jimmy Cagney started laughing maniacally like the Joker in the middle of a chemical building, I had visions, Nolan.
Of Jimmy Cagney as the Joker.
Which is a weird vision to have, because while the Joker did exist in 1949, this kind of thing did not happen. And I almost feel, it almost feels sacrilegious to be talking about superhero movies and old Hollywood in the same sentence.
I mean, they had Batman movies in the 40s. Granted, they weren't very good, but...
Well, silly things, though. Not real movies. This is a real movie we're talking about. But I couldn't help... I couldn't help feeling that. Which I suppose made me enjoy it better, because I kind of understood the mania there. Or I at least appreciated the mania in Cody Jarrett at the end of this movie, who is just so single-minded, he literally just wants to make his mum proud of him. So when you get to Made It Mar, Top of the World, and then he essentially blows himself up with fire and chemicals, it's, you know, you've got to imagine that at least Cody Jarrett probably died happy, because he may have finally thought, at least truly, that he'd actually made his mother proud of him, despite the fact that his mother kind of constantly says in the movie how much she loves him and he's proud of him. He's a very insecure person. He really is. I'm worried for Cody Jarrett. I mean, I shouldn't be. He's a fictional character who dies at the end of the movie. But I don't know why. I'm worried for people like him. You know, insecure people who get told that they basically shouldn't be insecure because all their insecurities actually make no sense, because the person they're, or the person or people they're feeling insecure about actually tells them the things they're feeling insecure about is wrong. Yet they still feel insecure about it. I worry about those people, Nolan, because it's tough. It's tough.
Cody, listen to me, man. Listen. You don't have to be insecure. You're a beautiful man. Look at you. Your mother loves you. Your gang loves you. We all love you. Learn to love yourself, man. Cody.
I think that's it. I think that's it. I think Cody Jarrett just needed to love himself. He needed to listen to Whitney Houston.
Self-love is important, Cody. Self-love is important.
He needed to listen to Whitney Houston and learn to love himself. because that's the greatest love of all. Yes. Success. I would actually like to begin to potentially wrap up the discussion by bringing up a point that I found really not hilarious, but just very interesting.
The ending.
Not the ending. In the background, I suppose behind the scenes of the movie, I opened with a little bit of a behind the scenes story. And I would like to end with one, because the influence of this movie, Nolan, and the relationship between Cody and Ma Jarrett came from a real life criminal family and their mother. It was the Barker brothers and Ma Barker, who basically acted like Ma Jarrett did in this movie, where she kind of goes about with the gang, gets involved, is a criminal herself. I think at one point, Ma Barker in real life, I think it was in the 20s, was FBI's most wanted. There's a very serious kind of organized crime family. But I like it. I like that bit of influence. It's always nice when you get movies based on, real life, or crime movies based on real life criminals. In that way, I believe the relationship between Ma Barker and her four sons in that real life gang was rather, similar to Cody and Ma Jarrett here, where there was a kind of dangerous level of devotion to each other. But I like it more because Ma Barker influenced the song Ma Baker. Well, not influenced, it is based on it. Ma Baker is, of course, a great song, Nolan, by everyone's favourite Caribbean German disco band, Boney M. And it's a great song, and I implore everybody to listen to the song Ma Baker if they haven't, because it's a great song. I just wanted to basically shout that out, because I will play that song at full volume, and any Boney M song, in truth, at full volume in the car, because it's great. So, yeah. Just wanted to put that out there. Have you any idea at all what I'm talking about?
I just want to hear you sing Boney M now.
Oh, no, I can't sing Boney M. That would be doing a disservice to the wonderful people of everyone's favorite German Caribbean disco band. Nobody has a story like Boney. It's weird. They're a weird band. Love them. Really, really do. Anyway, that's that. That's White Heat. Do you have anything else, Nolan,
to say? I would say if you want to look at character studies and you enjoy that kind of movie and you want to learn more about how you show an unlikable character but still make them compelling, White Heat is a great one to check out.
It's a phenomenal movie. It really, really is up there with the best of gangster movies, truly. I was so much loving. That doesn't even make any sense, but I'm going to say it anyway. I was so much loving this movie, and very much do now, having seen it. Thank you, Morgan, for suggesting to watch White Heat this week on the main show.
You're welcome. Congratulate yourself.
You're welcome. Because I wanted to watch it. And I felt it was time. And I'm glad you enjoyed it as well.
I did.
I'm glad you enjoyed it as well, very much. But yes, I think there we go for this week's episode of It's a Wonderful Podcast. This has been episode 194. We've been talking Raoul Walsh's White Heat. Again, go and look at a picture of Raoul Walsh if you haven't already, people. Come on. R-A-O-U-L. Remember, it's that spelling of Raoul. He looks... Nolan said it before. What did you...
He looks like if you asked a child to draw a bad man.
Yes, that's exactly what he looks like. And it really is exactly what he looks like. I love him so much. Raoul Walsh's White Heat, 1949, with Jimmy Cagney, Virginia Mayo, and Edmund O'Brien. There we go. Edmund O'Brien actually won an Oscar, I think. I don't remember what for. I think it was a Best Supporting Actor Oscar. Not for this movie. Although he's very, very good in this movie. Low-key a favourite element of this movie, for me, is Edmund O'Brien. Absolutely. I love how strong he is playing against Jimmy Cagney, who I felt would just steal absolutely every scene. And while at times he does do that, Edmund O'Brien impressively held his own throughout the entire thing, and I just appreciated that. I wanted to give another shout out there to him. Yes. Nolan, have you got anything you would like to say coming up, situations about things, or other such nonsense?
Situations coming up about things, well, let's see, I'm just awaiting for them to have a fourth COVID booster jab, so I can get that out of the way.
Fair enough.
Back at uni now, joining with my theatre society, we are possibly putting on Dr. Faustus as a play this year.
Okay. That means, Nolan, that we shall have to do Faust. Murnau. F.W. Murnau's Faust from 1924.
If we end up choosing that play, I'll be happy to do the research.
Lovely. I like it.
And I'm just anxiously awaiting Avril Lavigne's new album. And, oh, well, I don't have a pick for next time yet, but I am going to pick something awesome. I want to do something, like, really fun for the next time I'm on It's a Wonderful Podcast.
Something fun and silly, not something dark and twisted and full of crime and nastiness.
Yeah, it depends on my mood on the day.
Fair enough. We don't mind fun and silly. We do like fun and silly sometimes as well. It's always nice to switch it up. Always nice. Where can everybody find you, though, Nolan? What is going on?
You can find me at NolanDean27 on Twitter, TheGlasgowKid1 on Twitter, and GlasgowKid27 on TikTok. I am also writing more material for my new comedy specials. Trying to test out new material at all Scotland's clubs. It's even possible I might even take a trip down to Manchester or Birmingham or something for a weekend to try out their comedy clubs if they have open mics as well.
Lovely stuff. Well, I shall have to come and support you in this part of the country if you were to come here.
Does Manchester have any good comedy clubs?
Oh, yeah. Search it. So, oh yeah, we know it does. It does.
I'm sure there's a Manchester comedian that I know of that's famous, but I can't think of his name now.
Probably several, really. But yes, there's quite a lot. Anyway, while you think on who that may be,
it's not Al Murray, is it?
I don't know. Al Murray's not from Manchester, I don't think. This has been It's a Wonderful Podcast, the main show, where we celebrate old movies, we discover new old movies, and we show love to, we never forget old movies on It's a Wonderful Podcast, and we hope you don't either. That is why we showcase them, that is why we talk about them, that is why we say, go and watch this movie, because it's great, and you're missing out if you don't watch it, and that is a fact. I'm sorry, but it really, really is. So, you know, do it. Do it now. right as you went, right as you're finishing this. Unless you've already watched it, in which case, yay. You're great, basically. It's a Wonderful Podcast. This show, the main show, is not the only show you can find on the It's a Wonderful Podcast feed, though. We have Machine Mondays with Janine, the machine of the movie Trivia Schmodown, who is back for Machine Mondays for the 2022 Schmodown season. Whole year full of great stuff. Schmodown related on a Monday again. We also have Morgan Hasn't Seen on Wednesdays, where Janine forces me to watch movies that I haven't seen, that generally, in fact, never are of the same era as movies from It's a Wonderful Podcast. We are still talking competition movies this coming week, as well as this past week, because we talked about the Jeff Bridges School of Gymnastics in Stick It from 2006. This past week on Morgan Hasn't Seen, I think we're doing Drumline next Wednesday, if I remember correctly. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, of course, here with the main show, we have you covered on the It's a Wonderful Podcast feed. You can find us on Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, CastBox, Amazon Music, everywhere else you get those sort of things. We have the Patreon as well. It's a Wonderful Podcast on Patreon. If you would like to support us that way, we would be most grateful. Or on YouTube. Well, I say and or on YouTube. And on YouTube. What am I talking about? It's a Wonderful Podcast for all the live discussions, the watch-alongs, the fun stuff that we do on there. Subscribe, do your notification bell things, and get us everywhere, because that's what goes on Twitter at It's a Wonderful One. You can find me on Twitter at The Purple Don, with a 3 instead of the E in the, because 3 is, of course, the magic number. On Instagram at just The Purple Don. That's going to do it. I will say goodbye. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode. What a fun time it has been. As always, you're all great. Nolan, see us out.
You know how I mentioned that Twitter was introducing NFTs?
Yes.
Well, Morgan, there's no point worrying about technology, especially when we're all going to be wiped out by the Large Hadron Collider. The Illuminati have built the Stern Accelerator to tear a hole in reality for God to fuck. The building of a Large Hadron Collider is a signal that our universe has become sexually mature. Any day we will see God's phallus pushing into our reality, dominating the skies above Switzerland. We will desperately try and shut the Hadron Collider down, but will only succeed in making the hole tighter.
Oh, God.
And who knows what God will ejaculate into our universe. No. It will probably take the form of ideas, or perhaps one contriving idea, perhaps the idea that we should have built a smaller Hadron Collider in Newcastle for God to use on his birthday.
What? I don't know what's going on.
You have no idea, but there's a twist. The Hadron Collider is actually a cock snare designed to trap God by the cock. And it won't be the Judeo-Christian God either, so there's no point writing in to complain about this bit. The Hadron Collider will trap Kronos, youngest of the Titans. His magnificent penis will span the skies as a time rainbow in all the 18 colors of time. And it is then, in our moment of triumph, that we will have overreached. We won't have trapped Kronos. He will simply be able to use our universe as a sort of Prince Albert.
No.
A cock ring with which he will pleasure the infinite folds of the multiverse. Your only consolation, as your universe thrives on the end of time's throbbing shaft, will be that at least you weren't born in the butt plug universe. That doesn't happen until you die in this one.
Wow. That was unexpected. I'm just going to say that. I mean, that's the lewdest set. Yeah. Kind of appreciated it, though. Well done, Nolan. Well done for leaving that image in all our heads now. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
God, everyone. I hope you come back after that.